machine gun man of yours to set your sights, your all the sights and all your other sights, your outside visual sights. Your team meant so much to you.
So you weren't playing properly, is that right?
Well, it didn't work with your team. You couldn't expect your team to produce up to the skill that you needed.
Now, on the Camel, you went to this training squadron. I guess the thing would be to get you...
Well, they wanted to make sure that you could do it. If you couldn't fly the Camel, you were sent to another school.
Bristol or whatever.
Whatever you
could fly.
Maybe you might be put down to a dear old, what they call the RE-8, and the troops call them Harry Tate, because he was a great... you wouldn't know anything about Harry Tate, but Harry Tate was one of the music hall entertainers of the day. So the RE-8 is a two-seater, and all it did is observe for our artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of cold meat for the fighters that came down. Every time that our friends that were on the RE-8 would come and see us the night before, and then they'd say, for God's sake, if you're in that area, rulers or wherever, they're going to be reserving the guns, keep an eye on us, because we're going to be there, and we'll be there cold meat. Well, of course, if they're our friends and we could do it, we did it. And because that is a good hunting ground where they were trying to get in the hunt, and then we'd catch the hunters.
Mm.
So it was good.
A lot of cooperation,
It had to be.
Had to be.
Yeah, it was.
Now, on the Camel itself, let me think. Did you have comic camels, or were they called that on the base?
Two-seated
camels.
Oh, that came in later, about a year later.
Oh.
They killed so many of them in the takeoff. But the comic camel, they had one in Canada. Roy Fleming flew one, and he was World War II type, you know. But he flew one at Camp Borden. He's telling me about it. It didn't fly like a camel, though. First of all, it was overloaded by an extra body that it wasn't designed to carry.
Yeah.
The seating arrangement was completely different, and that makes in the Camel, as it was originally designed, you sat right over that exact center of turning.
Yeah.
Now the word there's no the word the center of turning is a
pivotal point, I guess. Yeah.
It's a silly way of explaining it, maybe, but there's no other way. And if you moved him forward, he wasn't over the center. If you moved him aft, he wasn't over the center, or sideways. But if you were right on that exact pivotal spot,
it was part of the machine, I guess.
It was a different thing. So the pupil, being trained that way, it was better, because he'd become accustomed to the engine, he'd become accustomed to the fantastic swing of the aircraft and taking off. For example, in taking off, the Camel from the ground. That's where so many accidents took place. He wasn't accustomed. The pupil couldn't possibly be accustomed to the feel of the rudder at all, because once you had to take, when you started to take off, you started to put on your left rudder to counteract the tendency to swing, because the rotation, the torque of the propeller and that centrifugal force were both swinging the right.
You were really flying an engine, I guess. Is that what
you had to counter it and keep your aircraft straight. So you had learned to use a very proper use of the rudder to keep your aircraft straight. And by holding the more and more pressure on the left rudder as necessary to keep the aircraft from swinging the right. It is ground. To the sleeping pupil, the aircraft is just ground loop on them, right on the ground. And, of course, when he got there, they didn't get killed there. But when he got up to about 100 feet, the aircraft probably didn't want to turn to the right. He'd let it turn, and the thing, if it turned too rapidly, it'd turn him right into the ground. And that's where so many of them were killed.
It would just power right down.
Yes. So that was the fantastic trick that the Camel had. So when you learn to fly it now, come on down the road. When you really learn to fly it, and up at a height, you simply, and they wanted to, all you had to do is kick the full right rudder on suddenly, plus all the centrifugal force, plus the torque, all in one direction. All you had to do is keep the nose up. So you ease the nose up to keep it above the horizon, kick it hard, and you'd simply
180.
Do a 360. Oh, 360. Oh yes, you have 180. No good, you're upside down. That's well, that's all right. We can do that. But we used to do that too. But then that was showing off because you won't do any great amount of shooting while you're still upside down. But when you do the 360 degrees or about 300, you don't have to go the full 360. And you come around with your guns firing. You've actually revolved on a straight line, or approximately straight. Not quite straight, you know, but in theory,
yeah.
The distance that you to one side is just enough to let him over, the helmet shooting at you. And they're there. That's where
He'll
overshoot you. You're right in the position shooting. So you took advantage of all the built-in
quirks and...
Well, of course. Yeah. Why not?
Of course, everyone does. The camel had a funny suspension system, is that correct?
What
was it? The suspension system for the wheel. Didn't it have a...
No, it didn't.
Was it a rigid slammed in, or I thought it had a special tubing rubber thing, like for a shock absorber.
Well, set them out of it. All undercarts had some resistance, some...
Shock absorber.
Yeah, arrangement. But the camel had a fixed on the cart, and it was pretty damn good.
Now, would you have, there'd be no braking system on the camel?
No, not.
You would have a throttle button type thing to cut the power?
Well, we had that, but that was very seldom used because it was very hard on your engine. If you could fly it properly, you got the aircraft in with the factory just ticking over, and when the engine was just ticking over gently, there was very little torque, very little centrifugal force. All you had to do was fly your aircraft in, put it down. Now, when it got on the ground, if you got it on the ground, it was half too much. The tail skid, we had a very different type of tail skid. You could have a shoe on it if you like, but that sort of chewed up your aircraft, the aerodrome a bit. But the great thing to do was be able to fly it right in, just cut it down, and stay put.
That was in theory.
in practice. Yes, you could fly it beautifully if you had the skills.
If you're out there banging around with that throttle button and the release.
Well, you destroyed your engine. The tremendous shock on again, off again from a switch of that kind is ridiculous. The power. It's no good for
you. I guess you get ripped by everyone else in the squadron as well.
Well, you didn't keep him long. You just sent that little boy somewhere else. You either cut the mustard or else he went somewhere else.
What about tactics now? Were you being taught tactics at this point?
Very little. Very little. You got 99% of your training took place in your squadron. I'm talking about the 90% of your training. That's the word training, right? 90% of your actual war training took place in your squadron there. 90%. There was a little. We went to a gunnery school in Scotland. Briefly, we were only there couple of weeks, but you had very little time in the air, and your instructors had damn all experience anyway, and the very experience was probably a year out of date. So it wasn't
You know that at the time?
Well, they did their best. Let's give the poor devil the credit. They did their best for you, and with the material they had, probably that's because we remember what the sort of raw material we were.
Yeah.
But we actually got your training right on the spot in your squad. Once you picked the bit when the pupils came in, the new boys from the United Kingdom came in, you selected the best of your ability. I'm talking about after I was in a position to select. Mm-hmm. You picked the best ones, you get your fingers on them, and you did your best.
Bring them out on the operational squadron level.
Well, you didn't take them out the first day that they arrived there and put them through, you ease them into the battle.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about communication equipment? Could you communicate with the ground?
No, not in the fight.
Not
at that time. We didn't need to. What for?
We had our instructions. Spirit, I guess.
Oh, we were absolutely. You got your orders before you left, and you're on your beat, and we did everything under the sun. But you went out and did your job, and you came back. But you communicated with your other aircraft by the waggle of the wings and all sorts of signals. Any number of air signals from one aircraft to the other. And every time you got a first signal, the rest knew what the rest was going to come. You didn't need to wait for the second or third or fourth. And they wouldn't time. Some frequently you'd only get one or two signals from the whole formation.
Now you can fly formation flying?
Oh, yes. We flew this formation right from the beginning.
Right from the beginning.
We did get that. I'm sorry, we should have tried to. We got some formation flying in England. Well, that's some. But they didn't have the aircraft. They didn't have the instructors. They needed everybody in France. So we only had a few to do it. We weren't rich or overwhelmed with additional personnel, and there were far too few aircraft in any case, in train.
Well, you were selected then when to go to France?
About the end of September, or the first week in October.
1917?
Yes.
Which one did that be?
Number 70.
Number 70?
Royal Flying Corps. Right in the middle of the Battle of Passchendaele.
So you were Passchendaele.
Well,
air operations at Passchendaele area.
Well, we didn't go straight into the squadron as soon as we arrived. We went to what is called a pool, and then you were selected from there. As the casualty took place, you were picked and selected to go. And I knew, I remember very, very well, I think we were there several days. We could hear the guns by night and by day. They were madder than 80s. Why didn't they come and get us? What are we waiting for? And there we were sitting at Saint-Omer, that is in France. And that was in Passchendaele in Belgium, just up ahead. But we could hear the guns. You could hear the guns on a still night, actually, in the coast of England for the Battle of Passchendaele. But the water on the canal, still night, you could hear the guns on the coast of England. There was never such a concentration of guns in history, there before or after, than they were along in 17 and 18.
And my grandfather was back
then. Oh, well, you know.
George
Perks.
General Perks, of course.
Well, he was there, he got to be there.
Victoria Cross, back then, of course. And a lot of, it's a great battle, and I guess on the flag.
It was a great battle of it.
Must have been. I think we've had a pretty good start today, sir.
Well, switch off that and I'll tell you a funny story.
Okay. Or should I leave it on to the story?
Well, no. That didn't.
Or I won't get the story on.
Well, if you wanted to.
Okay.
It didn't happen to me, but it happened to a friend of mine. He was in the Army.
Yeah.
And he was at the Battle of Passchendaele. And they've been waiting for the rations would be cut off. See, the Army had the great trouble in getting their... they had the trouble of getting their rations right into the line.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the flying corps, we had that great advantage of coming when we came back from a flight, we were at least 10 or 12 miles in our forward aerodrome behind the lines, because your aircraft had to have room to maneuver. You couldn't build an aircraft in the front line full of, have your aircraft filled with potholes every day.
Yeah.
We got a few guns into our aircraft, in our aerodrome, and we were popping, and it was just behind each and so on. Well, anyway, a friend of mine was up in the line, and the rations arrived, and including the rum rations. And the rum came up in those days in a great gallon crock, beautifully sealed. And
the wicker basket around, too? Or?
I don't know. I can't tell you about the wicker basket. It got there in an undisturbed crock with the sealed in it with a good rum, and they were suddenly moved, and somehow additional crocks had got up. In the rations, and of course they never knew when they were going to get to the next lot. So, and they got orders to move. Well, they couldn't carry all this damn rum. So he buried a crock, and he measured right on the corner of where they had the stone markers and so on the road, the old markers. Some of it hadn't been disturbed by the war, the battle. And he buried his crock of rum, one crock that they didn't take anyway, down at X feet on that marker. And the exact spot, and he wrote it in his notebook, and the guard, he didn't come back that way at all. And after he'd been back in Canada about, well, at the end of War II, he got a chance to go back overseas on one of the trips over there, and he went back and he dug up the crock of rum, and he brought it back to Canada for his friends, unsealed, with still the original seal on that rum. And we sampled that original rum, and my God, it was uncut. The most beautiful rum by that time. It's been sitting down under the ground for all those years. So the cock of
your chum? Are you not divulging names?
Well, yes, he was in Edmonton. I'll tell you his name another time. He's in Edmonton. I think he's still alive. But mind you, he's in his 80s now. So he's alive. I haven't been back there for 30 years. But he brought the run back to Canada.
No.
With an unbroken, and I hadn't seen that for 30 years, 40 years. The run and the clock, the old Asia clock. And he brought that back untouched. I give him the loudest credit because I've never brought back.
Never brought back.
Well, I brought back the clock, but it was an empty.
Well, everybody, Marshall Housen, thank you very much. Next time I see you, I hope to pick up at the operational training level.
Yeah.
And
I'll tell you. Okay. Anyway, you like.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir. My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N, and I'm with Air Vice Marshal G.R. Housen, H-O-W-S-A-M, and Air Vice Marshal Housen has the PV and the FT and the CD.
PSA.
PSA as well. As well as numerous foreign decorations. Air Vice Marshal Housen is the Royal Flying Corps, and the RAF.
I object to that word numerous, but a number.
A number.
Yeah, please.
Air Vice Marshal Housen was with the Royal Flying Corps, then the RAF, and later the Royal Canadian Air Force. The date today is 3 August 1979, and we're at Air Vice Marshal's home on Paul Terrace in Victoria. The last day Air Vice Marshal, we got as far as you going to England, I guess, and getting your operational training, and going over sort of the agreed-upon questions.
I believe it's on the from memory. We left Montreal on the 19th of August, as I told you, and it would take about 8 to 10 days because we stopped off in Bantry Bay. So it would be toward the end, about the 27th or 28th of August. I don't think it was the 1st of September. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. No, 1917. Yeah.
Now, you get off the boat, you're a temporary second lieutenant in the Canadian Army. What the actual, you explain it, please. But
well, that is good enough, for temporary second lieutenant.
Seconded to the RSC?
No, in the RSC.
In the RSC.
We were not seconded, we were part of the RSC. We had been sworn in and everything else into the RSC in the beginning. As an air cadet, or as a flying cadet, we were. We didn't call them air cadets then.
Now, in England itself, were you given operational training there or sent to France for that?
No, you got your preliminary operational training in England. For example, we only, I think I mentioned that we had the Curtiss aircraft only, the Buffalo Curtiss first, and then the Canadian Curtiss, and that was all, because that's all that England was able to supply to Flying Corps in Canada for our early elementary and so-called operational training. Then we went to higher or more advanced operational training as soon as we arrived in England, and we were introduced to the good old Avro, which is a beautiful aircraft, but it did have the rotary engine that brought us up from the stationary engine on the Curtiss. We also went to a single-seater, which we hadn't flown before, the Bristol Scout, the forerunner of the Camel, and then from the Bristol Scout, the Avro first in England, then the Bristol Scout, and then that was followed immediately by the Camel, and that is our fighting aircraft. So we had a few hours on each aircraft before we were selected.
When you say a few hours, you mean that literally a few hours?
Only a few hours, because there just wasn't that much time. There was very little time. When you consider, all comparisons are odious, I know. But in the Second War, we had sworn a vow that what had happened to us would never happen again to any other. Well, in the event of the Second War. So, while I started my flying in May 17, and I was in France flying by September, the end of September, early October. Now, the same year.
Pretty quick.
Right under operations. Now, in the war too, we took a minimum of up to about 2 years, to between 18 months and 2 years, depending on the work they were going through. For example, I'm speaking now more of the pilot training, but you have a lot of other things You have air observers, you have wireless operators. We had about 14 or 15 different categories. All took different training in your air crew, your total air crew.
Yeah.
So each took a different length of time in accordance with the work they were doing. But for pilots particularly, we were taking a minimum of between 18 months and 2 years before they were allowed to go into operation. We did avoid that fantastic...
Yes.
Oh, in World War I. But they didn't know any better, and they had no... They needed them so badly, they were crying out for more replacement.
Yeah.
What could you do? Go ahead.
Now, you got to... I've seen the airplanes you were flying in England, which you mentioned. They brought you up, as you said, to the rotary.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, we flew the Camel. That's the primary aircraft that I was selected for. So you each, you went through, all the way along, you were going through a period of selection. Some people were too, the Camel was a rather compact little aircraft. Almost impossible to be too small, but because the height limit, you see, you had to stretch to get 5'7", 5'6½". You had to have that height. Some got in less by sitting on a cushion or something like that. But the larger man, we had a few pilots who were 5'10" or 11 or 6 feet, but the larger man had a terrible time tying knots in his legs, and it wasn't quite fair to him. So he was far better on a bigger machine and bigger type. And the old Canby Pages were heavy to handle, and the DH-4s and the DH-9As and a lot of others had plenty of space.
So the selection process.
All the way.
All
you're
the
going
way.
Through a period of selection.
Not only physical, but...
Everything. At that time.
So you were selected early for Camel.
Well, I opted for it and was able to get it.
Now, the Camel was a very delicate aircraft.
It's the most rugged aircraft built.
Yeah, touchy, I guess, on the...
It had
no room for mistake. Is that the way of putting it?
Well, normally, its great peculiarity was that it had, as I mentioned to you again and again, the propeller gave you torque. The rotary engine gave you the centrifugal action, and they're both in the same direction, and therefore, with the aircraft being so small and so sensitive, it had tremendously sensitive control, and they acted all right. But they were subject to overreaction or much too sudden, and that's what killed so many of our pupils in training on the Camel. Great number were killed. But once you could fly it, it is a magnificent fighting aircraft.
Flying an engine, I guess,
is they say. Well, you soon learn to take advantage of its peculiarities, its faults, if you want to call it, and you helped it along in the fault, and that's confused the enemy a little bit.
Well, maybe you get into that power flick roll you were telling me about earlier.
Right. Well, anyway.
Now, I'm just checking the things here. That you would have, what, a few hours on the Camel in England?
Yes. I would guess about 8 or 10 hours.
8 or 10 hours.
Yes, I would guess that. Because as soon as I got onto it, I concentrated to the fullest possible extent. I didn't want to revive it anything else. I stuck to what the love that I had already achieved for it.
Now, you would be going to France very shortly. Now, you're into the end of August in England. You're going through all this, getting familiarized with different types of machines, and then being selected for the Camel, getting trained on the Camel.
We went for a very short, quick trip to Ayr in Scotland. Yes, in the vicinity of Ayr, the golf course, and I forget the name of the place, close to Ayr, for our air gunnery. And we were able to do a little firing. Well, on targets, the ground targets. And we had one tow target to shoot at, but the tow target business was not very happy for the guys.
Going,
No. And I think I was able to shoot at the target twice, but it is limited.
Be a lot of
shots
and practice, I
think. Yes. Now, since we were given some chance to do a little practice and a little training in the squadrons as well. The squadrons themselves, that is the place where the final training took place at that time.
Now, you go to France in early September?
No, not early September. See, in late September.
Late September. You go over to Lake Ferry?
That's right.
As is it in
peace time? Well, not as is it in peace time, but they controlled it in any way they liked, but there were ferries going back and forth all the time. It never stopped, and you could go either from Calais or Boulogne, you could go to Calais or Boulogne, but we usually went from Folkestone. We went from Folkestone, and we landed at Boulogne, and then went by tender from Boulogne to a pool at St. Omer.
So
at
St. Omer, there would be a pilot's pool.
That's right.
But was waiting to be called up by the
squadron. Right. Actually, my criticism of it later in life was it should never have happened in that way, because it was completely unorganized. There's nothing for the troops to do. They had been giving them drill and that sort of thing, but that was stupid army drill. But there's a lot of other things that could have been done, should have been done, very easy to have done, if they'd had the experience. But they didn't have the experience. That was the first time that happened. That never happened again. There were various things. They had great concentration pools in the Second War, but they were handled very much better. We had skilled people there then that there's been the Second War who had been stung badly in the first one and knew what to do.
Now, you remain in the pool for approximately how long?
About the third day we were very upset and very, because we were told that, my goodness, the great need, and I think probably I was there 5 or 6, 7 days, and I was getting very itchy feet by the time I got out.
Now, you were selected by which squadron?
Number 70.
70.
Yeah.
And where were they stationed?
Near Poppering.
So this would be on what, the
Passchendaele area? Yes, immediately behind Ypres.
Ypres.
Well, the troops called it Wipers, but it was spelled Y-P-E-R-S or something or other, and we called it Ypres. I've heard every pronunciation in the world for it, so I won't argue. I wouldn't defend any of them. But it was the aerodrome was very small.
What was that aerodrome like to recall the facilities
of the aerodrome? Well, yes, indeed. It is one of the closest aerodromes to the lines in France, and in fact, it is close enough that the enemy could run a big gun secretly down. Okay, and did several times. They could shell our aerodrome with the guns. But you see, as an advanced aerodrome, it had tremendous advantages of being able to get quickly to a target. So you not only could fly there, but you could get off and be there almost before. And that is a great advantage of having an aerodrome. So as a fighter aerodrome, there was another fighter squadron there. Number 29 was there in the beginning, and they moved it away when they changed its aircraft and put in another camel squadron. So we had two camel squadrons there, 70 and 65. 65 came in right afterwards.
Now, what about hangars?
The old Bethanol. Canvas Bethanol.
So it would be canvas hangars.
All canvas.
Very low in comparison to today's standards.
Yes, a little lower, but not that much lower. The two or three old ones, you can see them in Alberta, were converted to, and the canvas taken off, and the framework strengthened, and they were boarded in, and probably... Well, they were all through war, too. Now, I can't tell you whether they're there now.
Now, what about messing facilities and barracks?
Well, there was a Besno hangar. Besno was a French name. And I can't tell you the same principle in all our huts. So, the simply corrugated arms in the form of a half circle. So it was just high enough for you could walk down the middle of the half of the diameter, and you could pile earth up around the outside of it as high as you liked, and but the actual work load of piling it too high would be self-defeating, and it might fold in on you in the middle of the night. So, however, you could have a fair degree of protection.
On the side.
Yes, for now the methane. And all you did is increase, put more of these together, longer and so on for your methane.
Well, the
sleeping quarters, you just took one half, you see. And,
yeah.
But now for the method, we usually had some sort of concrete, or not concrete, didn't have concrete, stone walls. You could build stone walls. There were plenty of stone walls, cinders and stone and one thing or another. And then you'd, by that method, you raise your half circle up higher. Uh-huh. And you got a higher ceiling and so on for your method. And just added more of them together. And also you had the great advantage that you could put a T onto it anywhere you like in the middle and cut a couple of doors and you would have
small
side room. So the ingenuity was tremendous. And the same with the chairs. You carried your own chair, you had two fronts, and you could steal the next one. You had one in the mess, and if you didn't, you didn't have it in one in the mess. You carried from your quarters into your mess. You had to be mobile, you know. You couldn't have too much.
Very mobile. Oh,
well, when they moved, what did you take with you? Largely what you could put on your camel. Break the camel's back.
Break the camel's back. Now, were you received warmly?
It was an old hat to them. But usually the flight that you went into took care of you pretty well that way. And you found, usually you shared a hut with one of these little huts with one person. So there'd be two to a hut, so somebody, you became somebody's roommate, and he probably had something to do with selecting you as to where you went, when you got into in the hut.
Now, you joined 70 Squadron in September.
Yeah, late September.
Late September 1917. It's a camel squadron.
Yes.
You have approximately, 20 odd hours, 30 hours?
I think I had 39 hours total flying.
Total flying, you would have approximately how many hours on camel?
Oh, I said something in the nature of 7 to 10 hours. I can't remember exactly.
So you weren't a seasoned pilot by any?
Oh, no, but as soon as you got in the squadron, if there were an aircraft for you, you had an unlimited chance to go on and improve your flying.
Send you off on your own?
Not over the line. First of all, it is important to the flight commander, your flight commander, to find out what kind of pilot you were. He put you on, he had a rigid way of testing you out. See whether you would obey his instructions to do certain things. He could see you flying from the ground, or he'd go up and lead you on a brief flight, and then he'd tell you to get out and go around the same circuit and do the various things. He'd send you out with different tasks to do, but certainly on your own side of the line.
Yeah.
Then as soon as he thought that you were inside of 3 or 4 days, I know I was asked to go along on what they called the line patrol. That was a safer one. They got you on the line patrol, a way where you could see the countryside and where you had a good opportunity to orient yourself, to know how to get away from your aerodrome and the way to get back, to make sure you did get back. And if you had to fly up through the clouds, he'd take you through the clouds, and then you came back down, you had to be able to orient yourself very quickly, and you had the compass, of course, to guide you, but a few miles from either side of your aerodrome, you would never come back down through the clouds in the same place. It's just impossible. So you had to know the countryside around you.
There's a great fear of clouds at this time, is that not correct?
No, some people found difficulty in flying in the clouds. We had very few instruments, you see. Yeah. You flew largely in the clouds at 3 feet. You did outside, for that matter, but you were flying more so. You should have had all these new instruments have been developed since largely by the need of the pilot. That's why the instruments were developed, and often by the pilots themselves.
Yeah.
But you soon learned to fly your aircraft.
Now, the, if this is correct, but what about, you're in a fighter squadron, what about specific fighter tactics? Were you given any, looking at question 25, any fighter tactics at all with your squadron, sir?
Well, definitely, yes, there had to be. But fighter tactics.
I think of training you.
Yes, I agree. Well, the fighter tactics developed a long way in War One. But at that earlier time, if you remember, the first thing they had to shoot at each other was, I think, it was shotguns or something or other. That had long gone before I got there. But by the time I got to France, we had two Vickers machine guns on a Camel.
Continental gear?
It was the Continental. No, it was the Cowper on the Camel to begin with. The Cowper was the mechanical gear.
Yeah.
It was very good until it got worn. And then when the mechanical parts were worn, of course, they started shooting holes through your propeller, and that was very bad. But when they were properly maintained and they worked beautifully, two, as I say, Vickers guns firing up to 600 rounds a minute, and that was an immense firepower.
But on the tactics themselves, were you taught anything specific when you first joined? I know later you would be developing your own then with your flight.
Very little in England. You had a very... I don't think we fired our machine guns in the Camel in England. I don't require firing. The only firing that I did on the machine guns on the range with a machine gun, but in the squadrons, they just didn't have enough Camels for training. And I don't remember any of... the flight commander might have had a pet aircraft of his own, but no one else flew, but I don't recall any firing. There was no firing range at Turnhill.
What about in France itself, though?
Once we were in France, then you had nothing else to do. You had your own air ground crew, and I had my aircraft on the range, testing the guns, testing the sights, day in and day out. And one wag said, "Well, if Housen's shot down as many Huns as he's got his aircraft on the range, there wouldn't be a Hun in the sky." But, however, it is something to do, and something for me to get accustomed to, and something for me to get accustomed to my team, the fitter, the rigger of my the engine fitter, the aircraft airframe rigger, mm-hmm. and my gunnery man. They were my tiny crew, and once you got to know them, I spent most of my time working with the gunner, because we improved our guns about 100% by just working with the brain of the gunner, and my small amount of brain was tremendously helpful.
Let me turn the tape over.